ist Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. This is a German podcast about contemporary music, but once in a while I do an English episode. I have studied singing classical voice, but I love singing lots of contemporary and experimental music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this in the show notes for you. And there you could also subscribe for my newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about themes all around new and contemporary music. I share with you behind the scenes, insider knowledge, and I want to bring the human beings out of the new music world closer to you. I'm cooperating with the NMZ Neue Musik Zeitung, which is a big German newspaper about music. Today I have an interview for you with the composer Toby Roundell. Toby Roundell is British, but he lives for many years already in China. And we had the opportunity to get a scholarship, a stipend by Goethe Institute for virtual residency. And so we had quite some Zoom calls within the last weeks and we developed a new piece. So in this interview, we will talk about all those things, how this piece developed, what Corona does with us, and yeah, how Toby became a composer. So enjoy the interview with Toby Roundell.
Hello, Toby. Toby Roundell, I welcome you today to my podcast.
Thank you. It's lovely to join you all the way from China.
I know. I'm in Düsseldorf and you're in China. I would like to know, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Well, it's been a bit of a journey, I think. I suppose when I was very young, my first real musical memory was the death of John Lennon, and which was sort of quite interesting. And my dad used to be a DJ, so when I was a sort of young kid, we had a lot of music around. But I wasn't born in a sort of family of musicians or anything like that. But I remember, you know, all these Beatles songs and Pink Floyd and all this sort of music in the 80s and stuff. And I suppose I sort of realized I loved music really through that, and then really began the journey, I suppose, of towards wanting to create music. And that's been a long, complicated journey. I think I tried going through the journey through education, the music colleges, but I wouldn't really say that was where things are now. And it's taken a long, long time, I think, to sort of discover it. There have been little openings along the way. So for instance, maybe in my teens, late teens, sort of starting to understand or come in contact a little bit with Cage and some of the sort of Stockhausen music, some of the minimalist music. But it really wasn't until I probably got into my mid-30s, maybe even 40s, that I sort of really started to have a relationship with what I would call sort of avant-garde experimental music, whatever that is, and start to make connections with musicians that I now have connections with, like yourself, and obviously some of the musicians from Pound Advisor, and some of the experimental musicians in the UK. Funny enough, I knew some of them when I was younger, but the penny hadn't dropped really. So it's been a long process. But I think that the more years that have passed by, the more open my taste has become, and now I feel like I've left a lot behind and moved into a much more interesting space. So it's been a sort of a blessed journey, really.
Yeah, sounds like a journey. What represents good, new and experimental music for you?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not really sure I know what good is. I don't really know. I think I'm not really sure it's for me to judge what is good. I suppose maybe something to do with the people that are involved and the dynamics of relationships, obviously existing in sound, but I try not to judge, to be honest. I think as far as something is good. No, I think it's more a case of just being with things and being interested to be with certain music or certain music resonating with me. But I wouldn't wish to dismiss something as good or bad. I think everything has a right to exist. So
you're very open-minded, and you can go in any listening experience and take something out from it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's obviously certain sounds and maybe certain music that's made great, but I've become certainly in the last sort of 5 or 6 years, much more open even to that. It's quite interesting to sort of observe sounds that perhaps do great or music that does great, and then to actually reflect on why that grates. And that's quite interesting as well, because it's more about coming to terms with that. And I think once you face that, then actually realize that maybe it's not such a problem anyway. And those sounds, oh, that particular type of music becomes sort of easier to sit with, I suppose. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that I want to be with it, but it's what exists at that moment. So I have to sort of accept it, really. I enjoy, as I said, I think a lot of it is to do with the people that you're listening with and the space that exists with the people that you're listening with, and having the attention and engagement in that experience. Yeah.
And what are the qualities you most appreciate in the performers you work with?
Oh, that's a good question. It's always a great blessing to be able to work with performers. I live, you know, quite far away from the music scene in many ways, and I've worked with quite a range of performers, from young children up to young children through a sort of spectrum to musicians who are very, very wonderful musicians and that have developed careers in music. So I think obviously an openness, wanting to engage in a relationship and engage in a journey together are very important. I think also some form of sincerity and integrity in each individual, but I think that's also there to be discovered as well, because a lot of it again has to do with the relationship between two people, or maybe even more, and that it's the exchange in there that's very interesting, the dynamics that happen, and whether there is shared territory. I think, you know, in my musical journey, I've certainly, when I was younger, and you used to put in pieces to go on particular composition courses or things like this, you would come across performers where maybe you didn't share that much territory. But that again was interesting as well, because one has to find a way, and sometimes very interesting things emerge and important lessons come out of it. So I think every single opportunity that there has been, there's been something that's come out of it. But it's wonderful to work with people who want to work with you. And I do enjoy also, not just in a compositional point of view, but also in just making music, I do enjoy working with children as well. I find they're very, very open to ideas. Some of the things that in China that we've done with some, you know, young teenagers, with some of the pieces from Vandalweiser have been absolutely fascinating how they've responded to it. With so much sort of vigor and interest, and it really opens your eyes. I think that openness is very important.
That is very, very wonderful. You just mentioned Vandalweiser again. What is Vandalweiser for you, and how did you become part of it?
Well, I'm not sure I'm completely part of it, but I suppose I first came across it. I knew a little bit about it before I started doing some work with COMA, which is now called Contemporary Music for All, but it used to be called Contemporary Music for Amateurs, which is a sort of loose organization in the UK. I think actually they've got something in Germany as well. James Weeks, composer, I think you know, he did a course on Vandalweiser, and that was really, I think, when it came up a little bit more in the surface. Although I was aware of it, but it came a bit more into the consciousness, and then more and more people I came across, it seemed to be part of conversations. It seemed to be part of my interests. The more I listened to the music from composers within this collective, the more interested I became. And then, eventually it ended up with meeting Antoine, which was a wonderful blessing. And that really opened some fascinating doors. I went and spent some time with him, and it really was a very special 10 days or so. And then I had the opportunity to meet more people within the collective or associated with the collective. I think obviously the history of it is interesting as well. And some of the characters that have been, or individuals that have been involved in it from the early stages, and their impact and influence, and that the way that they engaged some of the key questions I think that Cage came up with was fascinating. It seems to me to be a collective of friends, a collective of people who, or maybe not even a collective, just some sort of loosely linked, evolving, I wouldn't even say an essence, but just quality that permeates across boundaries, that's interested in something that seems very fundamental to the creative experience. So, special group, I think.
It is. And we will also talk about it later. You're composing also for the human voice, where I'm very grateful for. How is this for you, and what is special or challenging about writing for the human voice?
Well, that's a good question. I think a couple of things. There's no sort of intermediate with the voice. There seems to be something very connected with the soul. And which is much more direct, I feel, than any other option from a compositional point of view. And this relationship with the soul coming from deep inside, I find this very special. And obviously, all the relationships with chanting and language as well, this integration with language, these interesting and sometimes very complex dynamics between texts that can be quite loaded, and responding to those. I certainly find when composing with the voice that the text is very, very important. And this, the combination of text, voice, words, sound, all together, and space as well, seems to me to be very profound. So I suppose another thing is actually being able to sing it oneself. Sing oneself, it's a stronger connection. So a lot of the work or compositions that I've been working on in the past few years, almost exclusively for voice, and being someone who lives halfway across the world and a little far away from many performers, it's also being able to be involved in that practice as well for myself. I think those are the fundamental things, and also something to do with the breath, which is obviously key to life. I think it's the closeness to the source of the human being. It's this idea of the word being able to come through, well, that is really what the voice is all about. So
I find that too. It's very, very personal, and I also enjoy it when composers like you are in a way also able or sing the stuff themselves, because I always have the feeling that the music is often composed or written differently if the composer him or herself has sang it in a way or just produced it in the head somehow. It's a different quality, and I always enjoy that also when composers demonstrate it to me, and because I get oftentimes a different feeling that maybe I don't find myself or just looking at the score. So yeah, that's great.
I do love singing, although I don't sing to others. I suppose the sort of singing singing psalms or chanting psalms, perhaps in a monastic type of way, which is, I have some sort of relationship with anyway. It is like a sort of offering, and a very I think it has a very cathartic quality to it, which is, I think, is sort of almost an essential aspect of life. And I find it difficult how people can sort of almost exist without having it. It's some sort of expression, a deep expression that you can't, I can only speak for myself, but it would be like cutting off a whole dimension of one's being to be able to not express things with the voice. And the pitching of it, and I'm not talking about musical pitching, but this idea of elevating expression from moving from the spoken word into, I think even when one sings, there's a different mentality, there's something going on that's very, very different, and the maybe the consciousness or awareness is raised through that. That I, again, you know, with the sorts of texts that I work with, I find interesting, that relationship.
Well, right now we're at the Corona pandemic, and mm-hmm. I would like to know how your life has been since then, or what has changed or happened. How is your life in China?
Well, I think it's been in China. Usually I try to get back to Europe in the summer, so this has been different, to sort of be a little bit more in one place. And so I suppose things have become a little more static in some ways, or at least, you know, in where I am. But that's also opened up opportunities, I think. It's interesting to be in a place for a bit longer. Well, I mean, I've been here for a long time, but, you know, usually at a time of year when we may move around and try to, you know, see various people, things like this. It's been interesting to be in one place and have time in one place where not much has really been going on, a lot of space to be. So I think, you know, it's offered the opportunity to reflect a lot on, and I suppose get a little bit more used to myself, who I am, yeah, I've sort of quite enjoyed it, really. I hope the virus obviously clears up. And I probably don't want to get into a sort of political talk about the whole thing, but China's handling of Corona has been, I think, very effective. So actually, although we've been living in China, we haven't really been that impacted, apart from just not being able to leave the country. But their handling of cases has been, they've been very, very efficient. So there's been no sort of real sense of threat here, which I think maybe perhaps has been different in Europe, for instance. And people here have been much more, well, I don't know actually, but the way people view the virus and their interactions with each other, they're much more concerned about not passing anything on to anybody else. It's less selfish perhaps than the sort of individualistic outlook that I hear about in the UK. It's been a good period, I think.
Okay, well, we're here now. I mean, I always like talking to you, and we also like working with each other for a while. We will talk about that too. But now we're here because we are very, very lucky. We got a stipend or a support from the Goethe Institute, and it's called virtual residency. And so we had to, you know, develop a project or something we wanted to do. And then we had many Zoom calls, which were very enjoyable and inspiring, at least for me.
And for me.
And we also had the opportunity, you know, to talk about meditation. And then we developed, or you composed, obviously, but we had many talks on it, the O antiphones, and that they will become music. And I want to perform them, hopefully very soon or before Christmas, we will see. So maybe to, yeah, let everybody know, what are the O antiphones, or the great antiphones?
Well, the great antiphones are a series of seven antiphones that are sung in Advent leading up to Christmas. An antiphon is probably the best place to start. An antiphon is a short, usually biblical text that frames a psalm or one of the major canticles, which is sung in the office in monasteries. The two main offices in a monastery, it would be Lourdes, which is in the morning, and Vespers in the evening. And So they punctuate or frame the psalm and the Magnificat or the Benedictus. And the O antiphons are these seven very important antiphons that lead up to Christmas. So they're allocated or linked to specific days within the liturgy and within the Christian calendar. So the first one's on the 17th, and 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st, 22nd, and the 23rd of December. And each one addresses the coming of Christ and addresses Christ in a different name. So the first one, for instance, addresses him as wisdom, and the second one as the ruler of the house of Israel, and on it goes like this. And they draw. They're not particularly long. I mean, they're only a sentence or two. Well, they're two sentences each, I think. And they draw from most of them draw from Isaiah, from the prophet Isaiah, who basically, obviously, in the prophecy anticipated the birth of Christ. So those are they are important. I mean, they're not called the great antiphons for no reason. They're unusual in the sense that they're sung within. Within a penitent type of way, because Advent is a sort of fasting month rather than a feasting month. Hence, there's no Alleluia. But in the Easter day, for instance, in Holy Week and Easter, there's no antiphons because they withdraw antiphons. It becomes very bleak indeed. And there's a sense of waiting, anticipation for Christmas, for the birth of Christ. Mm. So that's essentially what they are.
Great, yeah. And you have wanted to do them for a long time. And so when I wrote you that there might be the chance to get this virtual residency, you had this idea that we should do that, which I really like, and I'm looking so much forward to actually sing them. And then we also reviewed our past work because we met at Klangraum in 2017, and there you wrote psalms for five days, I think. And that was also a very great experience because we did some of the psalms were very long. And I sang them at Klangraum. And then we also did a piece for Pentecost.
Mm-hmm. That was an antiphon as well. Yeah,
it was an antiphon as well, and so we talked a lot about this experience back then and how it. I mean, yeah, it changed. I think it also influenced you or changed or did something with you how you now composed the antiphon. Mm. So, what would you like to say about that, or do you want to give a quick review on Klangraum?
I think coming back maybe to one of the earlier questions about Vandelweiser and maybe experimental music, I suppose in most new music that I've come across, there's a concert and everything happens, and I suppose one writes a 20-minute piece, and there it is, and it's finished. And I think the thing about the opportunities within Vandelweiser and the opportunities within these is that these occupy a very different space. They're concerned with things that happen on a day basis over a period of or accumulation of days. In many ways, I'm actually also very interested in the accumulation beyond days, maybe even into months and stuff like this. So this sort of concept of a series of moving, or maybe not even moving, maybe there is no movement at all, but this just being in these particular spaces or whatever they are on a day-to-day basis. So when we worked together in Klangraum, the theme was, I think it was from day to day. And these psalms, there was a a daily psalm. And there was a journey, and from one to another, there was a, I think if I remember correctly, first psalm was 103 or 104, which was about the creation. And this sense of just moving from one day to the next, and the psalms existing there as a prayer. And it, I think the weight of having to sort of compose music drops because it, particularly in prayer, because at the end of the day, prayer is very, it's very flawed, and it doesn't really matter. The intention is the important thing, and being able to pray, which essentially is what the Psalms are about, I think this just dropped the weight of having to sort of compose music and just let it exist. And I certainly remember in Clangrum certain cases where something happened. It didn't really matter because it, I suppose in the same way like monastics would every single day go into their chapel as a group would pray. Some days it's magic, other days there's just all these frictions and tensions that are going across the choir. Some days things just go completely fall to pieces, but one just gets up and gets on with it and carries on and continues. So this is what I rather love about it. And the O antiphons, I think, are an extension of that, of moving from one day to the next. And in fact, as you know, I've just sort of worked even with the original Gregorian chant, not really done a tremendous amount to it, because I can't see any point in changing it, because it is what it is. But it's also interesting to see it or to experience it in a different type of space. So yes, I it's this opportunity to be able to work over very different timescales, I think is something that certainly interests me and opens up some very interesting dimensions.
Yes, it's very essential. I can feel that when you talk about it, or when I was being part of it, mm-hmm. And I also like that too. That in a way that a lot of other things are like stripped off and something remains, and that's
yes. Well, we talked a bit about that. I remember over Christopher Korn's piece that you did this year, and I think from our conversations over this month, this interesting relationship between this transition between sound and no sound. The intermediary aspect, where does it exist and where doesn't exist, and where does it then come back in? And I find this very interesting. It plays with, it poses some interesting questions around perception and reality and being. That to me seems to be what it's all about. And I think that opens up these interesting gaps as well. This every transition opens up an opportunity. This opportunity for light to come in. So yes, it's very exciting.
Yeah, about presence, and a long time ago when I got close to Wandelweiser and had many very deep talks with Antoine. I also asked him, then there is silence and then maybe I can sing again, but oftentimes it's free when I sing. And then I said, sometimes it's also hard for me to now destroy the silence because I enjoy it so much. And then I also noticed that I'm often going with my breathing And then when I feel I breathe in, that's another opportunity to start singing again. And then I asked him, is there any like right or wrong to continue? And he said, no, because he said, it's always then a decision. It is a very important decision you make when to continue again. And it's a big decision, I must say.
Yes.
That way, because, you know, when I just sing notes that are more close or a melody, in a way it's easier because that's what I always do. But then to kind of, I don't know, master the silence or that's maybe too hard a word, but it's, yeah, I decide when there is silence and when there is a sound on my voice.
It's a very personal decision, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. That's lovely. It's what it's about, I think.
And how silence also can change. And last night I had a concert at the Niederrhein where I sing my program with Hildegard von Bingen and John Cage. And there's also lots of silence. And I also made a little introductory and explained it to them. And they were cool with it. And it was a church where also a street close by, so we could hear cars. And they had the concert at 5 o'clock. And then I think it was like 15 minutes before six, the bells, obviously from the Catholic Church, started ringing. And at first I thought, okay, cool, it's part of the whole thing. And I thought, like, okay, it rings a little and it will be over and I wait for it. So I was waiting. But then I realized, I guess after, I don't know, felt 2 minutes, the bells are not stopping. Or maybe not another 15 minutes or so. And then I decided, okay, I will sing with the bells. It's my drone. And then I kept going. But also for the audience, it was very interesting because they're like, in such a quiet program, it might have been also nice. The bells were not ringing, but we cannot, you know, go to the Catholic Church and say, well, we have a concert tonight. Don't ring the bells. I mean, they could change the time of the concert. And so I always make decisions.
Well, I think the bells probably go very well with the Cage and the Hildegard as well. So.
After a while, I was fine with it. But at first, I thought, like, oh, it's going to stop. It's just like, I don't know, a short bell ring. But it wasn't. It was really very, very long.
We don't have bells in China, sadly, or at least not church bells. So.
The other thing we talked a lot about during our Zoom calls was meditation, because I know you have great experience with it. I have some, and I continue to do more and more longer sessions since actually the shutdown, and I'm really enjoying it in a way, and it changes things in my life. So what meaning has meditation for you, or also during Corona?
Yeah, I think it's important for me. I'm not quite sure why, but it's something having these times to sort of sit by myself and maybe concentrate on my breathing or something, and particularly very early in the morning, I think it enables, at least for me, an opportunity to sort of get to know who I am better, and to see what's going on in my mind a little bit better, and maybe probably even in my heart. I've over the last year or so, it's really become something that's sort of built into my life. You know, I've tried to structure it into my life. Not that alone. I mean, I'm still, when I I don't think I mentioned yet, but I spent some time in a monastery when I was in my 30s, I think. And obviously that's a very, it was a contemplative monastery. So essentially the small community that I was with, they never left their dwelling or monastic grounds. And being able to partake for a decent length of time, you know, this life, this sort of cycle of getting up early in the morning and going and chanting the various offices throughout the day, and then having time to in the daytime in one's own cell to be able to meditate, pray, and read as well. These seem to be really important things, and I think, you know, in the secular life, it's difficult to do it, but I think it makes a big difference to be able to have that space, to be able to recharge and focus on the essentials, or maybe not even actually on the essentials, just to be able to keep on coming back to one point and maybe to observe. I always think this idea of being able to, it's almost like sort of gate one's soul, really, just to observe what's going on. Not that necessarily a lot's going on, but just to be there and observe and see how things are emerging. And I suppose, you know, in relation with a lot of Vandelweiser music as well, and not just Vandelweiser, but some of the other music that I'm interested in, there seems to be some aspect that sits comfortably with this meditative state of being able to wait, deal with pain, learn how to handle that, and also learn how to handle the opposite as well, the you know, good feelings, so that can stay sort of balanced through it. So yeah, it's an important aspect. I find it's helped sort of always helping grounding my own being.
I totally understand, because it helps me too a lot, and in that way I'm grateful that through Corona I started doing more, and I also have the feeling I get to know myself better, which is nice.
I think a lot of people have. I mean, it's, you know, the circumstances have changed, and having to live by yourself or with other people, and not having the freedom to sort of run away, and does sort of present this thing about having to face some really important questions. And that's why I think there are certain things within COVID-19, there have been certain blessings, and it's been fascinating talking to, I mean, you know, I've got a lot of colleagues out here, not necessarily, you know, not in the music industry per se, in education. It's been fascinating talking, you know, sort of meeting up with them again as a new academic year begins, and hearing about all the things that people have done. You know, so many people have like taken up yoga more seriously, or got fit again, and started running, and all, you know, all these what I would call good decisions, which in the hubbub beforehand, the craziness of beforehand, you know, many people were letting these things slip. And sometimes these, something like COVID comes along, and it gives one an opportunity to realign things that are important and identify the priorities. So, yeah.
I'm also kind of looking how I can now bring everything together, because during Corona, it was for me easy to meditate or find the time or do good things for me. And for a few weeks, I'm working a lot again, which is also nice. Yeah. But I'm really looking forward to find a real good balance, because that was the part I also enjoyed a lot, and it gave me some inner peace. And so I wish to connect it now.
Yes, that can be difficult. I think it's that's quite a challenge. I mean, things drop. I suppose we all change, don't we? So and sort of grow in different ways. So some things will probably drop, and other things will stay. And hopefully, the things that are important stay.
For me, it was also interesting. I mean, we are kind of at the end of our period for the virtual residency by Goethe, and we had quite some Zoom calls, and we talked a lot about things and about the piece and our experience with music or the music we have done together. And for me, I mean, I'm always so curious how people think and feel and what is, I call it, behind the scenes. And so it was so fascinating for me to be, in a way, part of the composing process. And so for me, I'm also curious, did the process change for you? I mean, conversing with me, or I mean, usually you maybe compose more on your own. How was it for you?
I think certainly. I mean, it's been lovely. As you know, I wanted to work with these antiphons for quite a long time, and I suppose I had some sort of concept of what I was after. What's emerged is certainly not what I anticipated at all. That's been the consequences of our conversations and, our exchanges. They're really positive consequences. Consequences sometimes sounds like a negative word. I don't mean it in a negative way. So they're very positive outcomes of our conversation. And I think, being able to reflect back on the projects that we've worked on, and also to talk about Klanggram this year, which you've been involved in, and be able to sort of experience that through you. Obviously, I'm not being able to hear or see anything, but at least to be able to discuss things has really helped. And it's been a lovely process. And I know we still have some way to go, although our official time is coming to an end. But I know our journey has further to go, which is very exciting as well. So yes, thank you.
I'm excited too. Our journey, and it was. I mean, I would have loved to seen you here this summer, because I think you plan to come, and we will see each other another time.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
But I'm very grateful to Goethe that they had now this opportunity, and that we could talk like that, and we really had then this focus and really met regularly on Zoom, and something happened. I mean, I think when we now have less Zoom calls, I actually will miss you in a way. I'm used to it, but well, that's okay. We are at the end of our talk, and is there anything you want to say, or how to conclude this great conversations we had today, which will be part of my podcast?
Oh, I don't know. thank you. All I can say is, it's been lovely. I'm very grateful and thankful to have the time to, to be given the opportunity, and also today to be able to talk to you today as well. It's been lovely, and it's exciting that we'll be able to move on as well, and sort of continue. I'm sure we'll sort of establish something and be able to continue beyond this as well. So, very, very grateful. So, thank you.
I'm also very, very grateful to you, to Goethe, and maybe also to the technique that we can actually converse like this today. This is also very interesting, and how we, even though we are really far away from each other, how we can talk so nicely, and it feels so close in a way. Well, then, thank you very much, Toby, and we keep in touch.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you.
This was the interview with Toby Rondell. And again, I'm very thankful that Goethe Institute supported us. I really hope that this interview inspired you, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you through Facebook or email. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I hope that you liked it and it inspired you. And I'm looking forward if you could recommend this podcast to your friends and colleagues. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.